This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org. Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's been called the breakthrough of the year by the prestigious magazine Science, and that sentiment's echoed elsewhere in the astronomy world about the European Space Agency's Rosetta mission, which this fall landed a little probe on a comet called Philae. The operation wasn't a complete success. Philae may have only lived about 2.5 days before it stopped sending photos and data. But there's hope that as the comet gets closer to the sun, the lander's solar panels will bring it back to life. Still, just getting it there was a feat, and its mother ship, so to speak, the orbiting Rosetta craft, remains in place and is expected to send streams of information and more cool pictures in the new year. Today in The Exchange, our sky guys have landed in our studios, and this hour they'll point their telescopes back at the top astronomy stories of 2014 and peer ahead at what we might expect next year. Let's hear from you, too, what discoveries or missions or big questions concerning space science caught your attention this past year. Give us a call, the Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our sky guys are John Gianforte, astronomy lecturer at UNH and Granite State College, co-founder of the Astronomical Society of Northern New England. John, it's great to see you. Welcome back.
Great to be here, Laura.
Also with us, Mal Cameron, retired astronomy and space educator at the McAuliffe-Shepard Discovery Center. And Mal, thank you also for your time.
You're welcome. Good morning.
Well, what would the sky guys pick as the top astronomy story of 2014? Mal, you first.
Gee, I get first choice. Well, to me, it has to be the Rosetta mission with the Philae landing. How do you pronounce it differently?
Well, but you've probably got Philae. It right. You're the astronomy guy.
Sounds almost like cream cheese or something. But anyway, but just the remarkable ability to go to an object that's moving as fast as this comet. The comet is simply called 67P. Normally, they name it after the discoverers, and the discoverers' names are Churyumov and Gerasimenko. And it's a little difficult to say.
So even they can't say it.
Even they can't say it.
I'm taking it was a Russian who discovered
right.
it.
A Russian group. But this comet has been incoming, and it's still got a ways to go before it gets very close to the sun. But here's the idea of the mission. The Rosetta was launched 10 years ago. Took 10 years doing swing-by gravity moves around Mars and around the Earth and so on, and finally caught up with it this year. And they were able to take this comet, which is, you know, a comet nucleus is very small. It's maybe a few kilometers around. It's not like a huge body. So mass-wise, there's not enough to create a whole lot of gravity. But yet they were able to take what tenuous gravity there was and go into orbit around this nucleus of the comet. And the idea is to follow the comet, stay with it all the way through its course going around the sun eventually, and see what happens, to learn about the processes that cause a comet to outgas and watch it outgas, and how does this cloud of material around the nucleus we call the coma, how does that form? And to ensure that they get even more information, they have this little thing called the Philae, which was attached to it, that they sent down to the surface.
Which is pretty amazing given how fast a comet is going. It's not like they're you know, trying to send this thing to a stationary object, which would be difficult enough given the size and given how far it is. But this thing's moving pretty fast. So I'm guessing that's why you're putting this on the top of your list, Mal. Top astronomy.
Exactly. To be able to catch up with it that way and to actually land something on top of it as it's moving too and spinning at the same time.
That's a big math problem.
It is.
And top astronomy story, we'll get back to Rosetta for sure because I have a bunch of questions. Top astronomy story of 2014 for you, John Gene Forty.
Well, I normally like to agree with Mal, but...
Really?
Yeah, yes.
Okay.
The Rosetta mission certainly is a high point in 2014, but I think a late-breaking story, just breaking last week at a conference in San Francisco, is the... detection by the Curiosity rover on Mars of the gas methane, which scientists have intermittently detected from Earth and from other orbiting satellites. But methane is a carbon-based compound, an organic, if you will, a simple organic molecule. And there have been outbursts, higher concentrations of methane seen sporadically, but unconfirmed, doesn't last long enough for multiple techniques to pick it up. But now the Curiosity rover has detected methane in the atmosphere and more complicated organic compounds in the dust of a rock that it drilled through.
Well, more information from those adorable little rovers that people like watching scooting on the surface of Mars. And here's my question for you, John, and I know you're right. There was a lot of excitement in the astronomy world about this methane discovery. Here on Earth, though, people hear methane and they think it's bad, isn't it? You know, sort of the number one greenhouse gas, worse than carbon and, you know, why are we excited about methane?
Well, we're excited about methane in other places because there is a possibility, by no means a certainty, a possible biological source for methane. Here on Earth, a lot of our methane is caused geologically and also by digesting plants by animals. So a lot of it's a waste product, and it is a very powerful greenhouse gas. On Mars, however, where the atmosphere is about 1% as thick as the atmosphere on Earth, there's not much of an atmosphere, and there's not much methane there at all. There's only maybe detected by Curiosity only 7 to 9 parts per billion. So it's not like it's a huge component of the atmosphere. But these periodic regional discoveries or detections of methane point to something interesting, even if it's geologic.
Even if it comes from rock and not past life.
Yes, because when we think of Mars, at least historically, most of us have thought of Mars as kind of maybe not a dead world, but just
pretty
a planet
close.
With one foot in, you know.
Yeah.
but this methane, even if it's geologically produced, it means that there is tangible evidence of geologic activity on this planet. And the other alternative, if it's biological, that's show
huge.
By itself, right?
Right.
I mean, that would be huge. But we're not there yet. We don't know what the source of the methane is. But believe me, that's a huge priority right now going forward with the rest of the mission.
All right. So landings on a comet and the confirmation of methane on Mars, the two top astronomy stories of 2014 from our Sky Guys. Join us with your questions and comments on these or other astronomy headlines that caught your attention this past year. Later on in the program, we'll look ahead to what some of the big astronomy events of 2015 might be. Join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Your questions and comments for our Sky Guys are welcome. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. So guys, just a couple more questions for you about Rosetta. And Mal, you explained it first, so I'll go back to you. Why is it important to study a comet? I mean, you see them streaking through the sky and it looks pretty, but beyond that, who cares?
Well, there has been a theory for a lot of years, first of all, that the water that we have on the Earth was possibly seeded on the Earth as the Earth was forming and there were a lot of comets flying around back in, you know, several million years ago, or billions for that matter. Our solar system is roughly 4.6 billion years old. And as things were forming and the Earth was cooling down, the theory has been that water is prevalent on these comets. It's basically a dirty snowball is what they think of it. And because of that, the tail of the comet has all this water vapor in it and so on. And the thought was that because these are big snowballs, that they were hitting the Earth long, long time ago, and that is where we got a lot of the water in our oceans.
And possibly organic compounds with the beginnings of life?
Well, possibly. It's interesting that so far what Rosetta has discovered just going around this comet, they did discover, of course, some water. They discovered a lot of hydrogen and also some trace amounts of methane, which is interesting to find on a comet. So that could be related as well. But one of the things they're thinking, they're discovering, is that the makeup of the water on the comet is slightly different from the type of water that we have here. It's called a heavier water. It has an element called deuterium in it, which our regular water doesn't seem to have. It's the hydrogen is split off. It's kind of like the same process you find inside the sun that makes the energy of the sun, taking protons, hydrogen atoms, and squeezing them together. And through the processes deep inside the sun, and in a four-step process creates the energy that lights the sun. The first step of that pushing these together creates this element called deuterium. And so it's hydrogen, it's hydrogen and oxygen coming together like we have for water, but it's a different type of water. So now they're starting to rethink perhaps that the water we have on Earth may not necessarily have been seeded by comets.
Well, again, we invite your questions and comments about this Rosetta mission, what we're learning about comets. We also want your comments at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Here's an email from Jeff that came in from Warner. He says, from Rosetta to Orion and the Mars discoveries too, what strikes me is the apathy and lack of classroom participation with any of these space exploration milestones. Jeff says, our schools are asleep and not paying attention to these extraordinary events compared to a generation ago when every classroom would have watched live on TV. Very sad. What do you think, John Gene Forty? Thanks, Jeff, for the email.
It's a great observation by Jeff. I think I was in a high school last week, and I gave a talk to a high school class. And normally I'm in a college classroom with students, which is always stimulating. The students are interested in astronomy. But I think students are genuinely interested in exploration and things astronomical. It's just that it doesn't get the media a focus and attention that so many other things competing for their attention get. Music, sports, a whole bunch of other things. So,
all right. I'll cut you off there, John, but we'll get back to this after a short break, I promise. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the top space stories of 2014. Our sky guys are with us, taking a look back at some of the major astronomy headlines of the past year. A little bit later in the program, we'll look ahead to what might be in store for 2015. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email like Jeff did, exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Two of the top stories that our Sky Guys have picked, the presence of methane on Mars, the significance of that. Also, the Rosetta mission studying a comet which managed to land a little probe on the comet. We're not sure if that probe is still alive or not. We'll find out more in a minute. But join us on those headlines and more, 1-800-892-6477. And, John, I did want to let you finish up. Jeff was emailing saying, you know, these discoveries that we're talking about today are, there's a big wow factor, and yet he feels like young people are just not engaged.
And I agree with his comment. I think he's right on. When I go into schools, whether they're elementary, middle, or high schools, students are genuinely interested in things relating to space, both manned and unmanned. Going to comets, going to Mars, the people, the students who are students now are going to be the first human beings to walk on the planet Mars. And that could be in 10 years, could be in 15, could be in 20.
So pay attention.
So it's going to happen, and the students that are studying now are going to make it happen and make that mission successful. So there's a whole family of topics relating to space that are really wow top stories. And landing on a comet, mining asteroids, capturing an asteroid, bringing it back to lunar orbit so we can study it more closely, those are all missions that are going to happen in the next 10 to 15 years. So I think there's a lot competing with young people's attention right now. And let's put it this way. There's no show that praises the 10 top scientists in all the different fields like there is the Emmys or the Grammys or the Country Music Awards or The Voice, anything like that. There's nothing putting forth the wonderful people doing this work that will eventually change lives on this planet. Just because we're studying astronomical objects doesn't mean it has no relevance to our daily lives. It may not today, but in years to come, it will.
Well, Jeff, thanks again for the email. The phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Jerry's calling from Dover. Hi, Jerry. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
Ever since I heard the theory about the comets bringing water to the Earth, I've tried to imagine how many comets it must have taken to bring this incredible amount of water that we have on this planet. And then if it wasn't that comets brought all the water, was there some chemical process that converted some other elements into the water that we have? And I'll take the question off the air.
Jerry, it's a great question. And one I had, too. I thought, okay, one comet, how much water can it bring? The Earth is huge. Go ahead, John and Mel, I want to hear from you, too.
It's a great, great question. And I once thought years ago when I just first began studying astronomy that the water that the Earth has probably formed with it. But that's contrary to what a lot of scientists think. The Earth and the other terrestrial planets, Mercury, Venus, and Mars, formed close to the sun 4.6 billion years ago or so. So the environment there was very warm, much, much too hot to allow water to remain on the planet. So any water that could have been possible at that time has been driven off by this intense heat present in the early inner solar system. If you want to know, comets typically are 4 to 20 kilometers in diameter. That's the diameter of their nucleus. They have a lot of water ice that's a part of them, and as do asteroids as well. But if you think, if you take millions of objects with that volume that are contained in that large an object, even if they were 10 or 20% water, over time, the number of impacts that have occurred on the Earth could bring a tremendous amount of water to the planet. Just take a look at the moon the next time you see it. The moon is covered literally shoulder to shoulder with impact scars. Every crater we can see on the moon with binoculars or a small telescope is the result of an infalling object impacting the moon in the past. The Earth, which is four times larger than the moon and much more massive, much more stronger gravity, has been impacted even more. So the potential is vast for external objects bringing some of Earth's water to it.
Well, and I have another question for you, Mal, Cameron, about the mission itself. We've been talking about Rosetta, the orbiter, the lander that went down on this comet. What happened to the lander? There were some problems there. This wasn't a 100% success.
Yes. Well, when the lander came down, it was supposed to shoot off some anchors into the surface of the comet to grab on because, remember, it's a small object with very little gravity. And
it's moving very fast. So it's amazing they landed at all.
Right. But if you could stand on that comet nucleus and just jump into the air, if you push hard enough with your legs, the chances are you wouldn't come back. All right, so you have to be very careful. So these anchors did not hold, even though they shot them off into the thing, but into the surface. That's the thing I'm talking about. One thing. But anyway, since it failed, what happened is it hit the landing spot it was supposed to hit, but then it bounced up into the air a little bit, but not enough to get free of that little gravity. So the gravity eventually pulled it down again. And it turned out it did two bounces. In the meantime, the comet was turning slightly underneath it, and it didn't really land where they wanted it to land, in a nice open area where the rays of the sun could hit the solar panels on the lander and keep it charged. And so instead, it landed in a shadowy area next to a cliff that blocked the sun. And very little bit of the sun actually hit it. So eventually, it ran out of its battery power. But
as we learned from its Twitter account, right?
Its Twitter
account,
yes.
It has a Twitter account that said, I'm feeling sleepy. Did you get my data? I think I'm going to take a nap now.
Right. That was very clever. It sounds like 2001 with Hal, you know. I'm going to sleep now, Dave.
But there's some hope, right, that as the comet gets closer to the sun,
right. There
might be more solar energy to wake it back up again.
Yeah, depending on how it's remember, it's tumbling slowly as it goes through space. So the hopeful part is that as it gets closer to the sun, the sun's rays get stronger, that each turn, maybe it'll catch a bit of the rays of the sun and come back to life again. We hope so.
Well, here's an email from Dennis in Barrington about, again, the comet. And it is a fascinating story. And even though it didn't go exactly as planned, still kudos, right, guys, to the ESA for getting this thing
Absolutely. There.
Sure. I mean,
absolutely.
Sure. So
yeah.
Dennis says, given the small mass of the comet, I'm curious what sort of velocity is sufficient to obtain escape velocity. Would a normal bullet fired from a gun not return to the comet? And Dennis says, how fast is Rosetta traveling in order to orbit? A couple good specific questions there, John. I'm just wondering if you can give us a sense of some of the velocities that we're talking about.
Well, the Rosetta spacecraft is in orbit around the comet. So the relative motion between Rosetta, the mothership, if you will, and the comet is pretty low. Okay? So the Philae lander kind of just was dropped out of the spacecraft. It wasn't powered, and it basically sank onto the surface of the comet at a very slow rate. It took hours for that to happen. So think of it this way. The Philae lander weighs several hundred pounds, but on the comet, it weighs less than a sheet of paper would on Earth. So imagine the force required to loft a piece of paper. You could blow a piece of paper.
Oh, I see, because there's so little gravity.
No gravity, right? Gravity is a function of the mass of an object. Low mass, low gravity. So we're talking an object made out of very light materials, only 4 kilometers in diameter, if you will. And so it has very, very, very low gravity. So a bullet fired from a gun would easily escape the velocity, escape the comet's gravity. You, as Mel said, could jump up high enough to achieve the escape velocity from that comet.
Not that you would want to.
No.
Space is not a very friendly
place. Well,
I wouldn't recommend
standing on the comet in the first place. But
right. Let's go back to our listeners. Great question there, Dennis. And Peter's joining us from Portsmouth. Hi, Peter. You're on the exchange. Thanks for calling in with the Sky Guys.
Yes. How you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a physicist by training, and one of the areas I studied a lot of is the so-called isotopic geology. And I wanted to kind of come back to the topic of the water on the Earth. And, you know, as we know, 71% of the Earth is covered by water. However, it was always a contentious issue of whether that water came from comets or asteroids. And the Rosetta space mission actually seems to have confirmed the fact that the water seems to have come not from comets, but from asteroids. And the reason this is because the element hydrogen has 3 isotopes. Regular hydrogen, 1 proton, deuterium, with a proton and a neutron, and tritium, which is radioactive, which has 1 proton and 2 neutrons. Well, it turns out the ratio of deuterium to hydrogen on the Earth is very similar to what you find with asteroid materials and not similar to what you find with comets.
Interesting.
So yeah. That gives us a hint that perhaps, in fact, we were not being bombarded with a lot of comets providing the water, but maybe a lot of asteroids were bombarding us. In fact, that makes a lot of sense because there's a whole lot more asteroids around in our area than there is comets coming in occasionally.
Right. You know, so, Peter, this is it's a fundamental point, isn't it, that we're digging into? I mean, where does the water come from? That is the whole reason we're here, right? I mean,
right. And water is, you know, you wouldn't expect water on the Earth because all the other planets around us, the inner planets, were much too hot, as was mentioned before, to retain that water. So it must have come from somewhere else besides the original development of the planets in the beginning.
Well, Peter, just stay with us for a minute, if you would. John Jane 40, yeah, go ahead.
To put it in perspective, you're absolutely right, Peter. The ratio of deuterium in Earth's water is 6,000 regular hydrogen atoms to one deuterium atom. That's what we expect. That's what we see in water here on Earth. Now, the Rosetta at the 67P has detected something different, that which would lead you to the conclusion you spoke about. However, past comets, where they have been analyzed from Earth and other spacecraft, have indicated a more Earth-like water content in their hydrogen. Now, if you consider that in the solar system, there are two separate and distinct cometary reservoirs, the Kuiper Belt, which is a flat belt out beyond Neptune, and the Oort cloud, much, much, much further, say 80,000 astronomical units out beyond from the sun, there's two distinct reservoirs. And possibly one reservoir contains a more Earth-like water, and the Oort cloud perhaps contains less. So that's a possibility. Mm-hmm. But definitely the asteroids have more Earth-like water. You're absolutely correct about that.
Wow. Peter, thank you so much for joining
sure.
us. Really
glad
appreciate
to do it.
All right. Bye-bye. It's so interesting to hear you, John, talk about reservoirs, like water reservoirs that we would see, you know, in any city that supplies the city water supply out in space.
Yeah, there's two separate distinct places where comets come from. The short period comets that have orbits less than 200 years come from the Kuiper Belt. And then the longer period comets that have periods longer than 200 or 300 years, come from much further away.
Let's talk back to the other top story that you guys picked, and that's methane on Mars. And Mal Cameron, John picked this one as his top story for 2014. He talked about how that methane has been confirmed by one of the rovers, Curiosity. There are two orbiters, though, that people are excited about going around Mars, MAVEN from the United States and I love this one. Mom. From India. How big a deal was it, Mal, for India to get an orbiter around Mars?
Well, what's really amazing about it is this is their first attempt to send something to Mars. And by the way, Mom simply means Mars Orbiter Mission. Mom. It does have a formal name, and it's actually called Mangalayan, which is a word that means Mars craft. But they call it Mom.
They really celebrated in India.
Oh,
this is a big
sure.
achievement for them.
Absolutely. This was their very first attempt. They got it there, and it's in orbit. It arrived 2 days after NASA's MAVEN mission. There's another acronym for you. That stands for the Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution Mission. They do anything they can to get these pronounceable acronyms.
Right.
But yes, the MOM actually has an instrument on there to measure things like methane.
In the atmosphere.
In the atmosphere. What MAVEN is doing in connection with that, too. The MOM mission, by the way, as I understand it, was more just an experiment with just a few simple instruments on it. It has a camera on it to take pictures and that sort of thing, just for them to experiment with and make sure they could do it. And I'm sure they're going to plan another mission down the road to be beefed up a little bit more.
Well, and there was some political stuff, too, around this. You know, India was mm-hmm. celebrating. It was a big milestone for them.
Right.
Kind of looking at their big neighbor, China, and saying, ha-ha, we can go into space,
exactly.
too. So there's some right. geopolitics involved in that as well.
Top this.
Let's go back to our listeners. Dan's in Milford. Hi, Dan. You're on with the Sky Guys. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate
sure.
it. I just wanted to bring up an article I read this morning about Venus and the potential for, I think I read correctly, putting dirigibles of some form in the atmosphere around Venus so that they could study, and they would be manned. So that they could study Venus. And I'd just like to hear the comments of your panel.
Manned yeah. orbiters, if you can call them that,
dirigibles
Dan, of Venus.
Some form. Yeah, around about, I think they said about 30,000 feet or something above the surface. But again, I'll take my I'll listen off the air.
Thanks. Well, Dan, thank you so much. Well, and John, you know, Venus is a nasty place.
Well, I wouldn't want a vacation there yet. But that's the surface, right? Venus is the hottest planet in the solar system. It's second from the sun. It has a very thick atmosphere, whereas Mars' atmosphere is 1% of the Earth's. Venus is 100 times thicker than the Earth's. So the atmospheric pressure at sea level on Venus is like 1,500 pounds per square inch, as opposed to Earth's 14.7. So it has a crushing atmosphere at the surface. However, because it has a thick atmosphere, it'd be easy to fly in. And there are temperatures and pressures in the atmosphere of Venus that aren't nearly as dramatic as they are at the surface. So Venus being a similar terrestrial planet to the Earth, it makes sense to want to learn more about that planet's atmosphere, circulation patterns, wind patterns, geology, to find out more about that planet's origin and evolutionary path. I mean, it's interesting. You have the Earth between Venus and Mars, and look at the extreme conditions on Mars, hardly any atmosphere, cold and dry, and on Venus, hardly any water, but super hot and with an atmosphere of poisonous sulfuric acid and sulfur dioxide. Earth is pretty privileged. It's important to find out why it's like that, and so that you learn more about our home atmosphere and habitat for life.
Well, and the more I've talked to you guys over the years, the more I appreciate just the atmosphere that we have here, Mal. I mean, it really
Absolutely. It
does so many amazing things for us, keeping the water here, keeping us safe. And when you look at the other planets that have too much or too little, you realize that Earth is just the ultimate Goldilocks planet.
Exactly. That's what they call it, the Goldilocks orbit that we have. And that's why when we're looking at other planets, like extrasolar planets out beyond our own solar system, we're looking for the planets that orbit in that same area distance from their sun that could give us the idea that perhaps there's a place where water could be in liquid form and therefore possibly life, who knows. But,
all right.
We are lucky.
After a short break, we'll look ahead to some of the possible top stories of 2015, what some of the events are that you guys are excited about, and more questions and comments from our listeners as well. So you can join us by email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow in The Exchange, the state of charitable giving in the Granite State. Today, the top space stories of 2014. Our sky guys are with us. We're looking back at some of the biggest astronomy headlines of the past year. And in a minute, we'll look ahead to what some of the big stories might be in 2015. Mal Cameron is with us, retired astronomy and space educator at the McAuliffe Shepherd Discovery Center, along with John Gianforte, astronomy lecturer at UNH and Granite State College, and co-founder of the Astronomical Society of Northern New England. We're taking your questions and comments about some of the stories we've been looking at. The two top stories that our sky guys picked, the presence of methane on Mars and all the implications there, or possible implications there, and then just this whole big question that we've been examining this hour, where water here on Earth might have come from, given the Rosetta mission to a comet. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And guys, before we move ahead to some of the stories you're excited to follow up on in 2015, and I know you'll be here to help us out with that, here's an email from Abe in Concord. He says, can the Sky Guys comment on the science of the movie Interstellar, specifically relativity of time between galaxies or the possibility of intergalactic travel? I love this question because I've been trying to get to see that movie, although haven't been able to with all the holiday stuff going on. Both of you, how about you first, John? Yeah, thanks, Abe, for the email.
I assigned this as an extra credit potential for my students at UNH this semester, and quite a few of them took me up on my offer. And then a few nights after, there was a lecture at UNH by Dr. Dave Mattingly, who gave a great talk and presentation about the science in Interstellar. If you're looking for a number of years ago, we did an exchange show with Phil Plait, the bad astronomer, who really has a list of really bad science movies.
Yeah, he's not a bad astronomer. You and he and I looked at all the bad astronomy science in the movies.
In movies.
It was a great,
that's his
show.
That's his handle, I guess you
right.
could say. He's a bad astronomer, but he's a NASA consultant and an astronomer. And he just writes on debunking public misconceptions about science and astronomy. But in Interstellar, they did Chris Nolan, the director of this movie, made a huge effort to put good science into the movie. And Kip Thorne, a retired physicist in California, who retired in 2009 and a colleague of Stephen Hawking's, is an expert on black holes and relativity, did a great job adding some good solid science and physics and some good theory on how a time dilation does in fact work. Yes, time does pass more slowly in the presence of a very, very strong gravitational field. In fact,
wait a second. Time passes more slowly? Say that again? I thought time was time and that's it.
Yeah, that's what we all think from our day-to-day lives as we go out holiday shopping and planning for guests and finishing up our Christmas and holiday business. But in the presence of a strong gravitational field, time passes more slowly. If you had a clock, a very accurate clock, and stayed on the surface of the Earth, and I took a rocket into, say, a high orbit above the Earth, you would feel stronger gravity than I would.
Right.
Your clock would run at a different rate than my clock.
Slower?
Would run slower. In fact, this is not just science fiction or a figment of some physicist's imagination. It is a fact of life. GPS satellites must take relativity into account because they are orbiting at a high altitude, therefore much further from the center of the Earth, which is where Earth's gravity centers around, and they have to have algorithms that take relativity into account. Otherwise, their time would slowly become less accurate. So that is a fact. It's not even a question. The degree to which it was practiced in the movie was probably a little bit of Hollywood. There's no library for more than likely inside a black hole. I'm not going to give away any more of the movie, but there is some artistic.
No spoiler alerts.
There is some artistic liberty in Interstellar, but pretty much many of the equations on the board were equations that are actual equations that describe the actions of general and special relativity.
So as an astronomer, you like this movie.
Yes.
You didn't sit there going, no, 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 no.
I only did that a couple of times, which is pretty good.
How about you, Mal? Did you see it yet?
I did. Enjoyed it. I had read some things from Kip Thorne as well, and realizing that he was one of the consultants on the film is what lured me to watch it. My wife and I both went, and she understood most of it, but I had a lot of questions afterwards. But I remember I'm with you, John. I think there were a couple of things, in particular the black hole section, that I questioned a little bit. It went against all that I've learned about black holes. But that's all I'm going to say.
Well, and of course, we don't really know what's in there.
Well, we
right?
don't. Or who's in there.
Let's go to another caller. Abe, it's a great question. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And you're reminding me that I need to go see this movie. Kyle is in Bartlett. Hi, Kyle. Thanks for calling in with the Sky Guys. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
I had a question. There was this process that was going through a couple years back for applications for people to actually go to Mars and live on Mars. And I was seeing if there was anything further that's been happening with that at all.
That's a good question. And Kyle, if given the opportunity, would you go?
Me? I don't think I could. No, I have a hard time leaving my hometown as is.
Well, Bartlett's a lovely place, so I understand. Thanks a lot for calling in. We talked about this once, Mal. I remember NASA was talking about the ideal astronauts to go to Mars would be a middle-aged, longtime married couple. Middle-aged, they're not going to have kids anymore. Longtime married, they know that they can be together in a capsule for 9 months.
And I believe it was a one-way trip, too.
Possibly.
That was one scenario.
One scenario was just there are a lot of people who just want to go. And I you know, and Kyle, if you're like most of us, you probably, if you don't want to go, I'll bet you know someone you'd like to send there, you know, in some ways. But
Mal.
No, I was thinking of this guy here.
John would go, given the opportunity. So what's going on, John, with the application process?
If I went and my wife came with me, she would want to come back. So I wouldn't volunteer for the one-way mission.
Yeah.
But that's only one scenario. There's other missions going. There's other, especially with the coming on in recent times of the private space ventures. Once space tourism takes off, and I know that's a topic for a future show, which I think will be great. Once that takes off, it'll make space safer, more efficient, less costly for the average person. It'll become a lot more realistic and bring the time frame in for people to go to places like low Earth orbit, the moon, and even Mars much more quickly than it would if simply the governments of the world explored space.
Well,
if
and,
I could
yeah.
just add to that
sure.
briefly, my thought is that there is kind of a race against the government-funded flights to Mars with the privately funded. And the way it looks now, for example, NASA just, you know, they sent their capsule up just to test it earlier this month. And it was a successful test, but that was only one test. And they're not even ready to send people up on one of those capsules until 2018.
Wow.
And they're predicting maybe they'll have enough together going slowly, cautiously, test, to send an actual mission to Mars with people on it sometime in the 2030s.
Wow, I thought it was 2025 last time
well,
we talked. Okay.
It won't be any earlier than that.
So to answer Kyle's question.
In the meantime, there are some private groups who really want to step that up a bit and see if they can get there earlier, even maybe by 2020 or so.
So is there an active, either of you guys know, is there an active application process like Kyle asks about to see if people want to go? It seems like the person who would want to go is probably 3 years old right now. I mean,
right.
It sounds like it's going to be a long ways
right.
away.
Well, there's not an active application process, but the avenues are multiplying for people for this to potentially happen within the next 5 to 10 years. So it's not that far beyond the horizon right now.
Okay.
And and there was an application, a call for applications for this one-way mission, right? So just to refresh listeners' memory, it was a one-way trip to Mars for a small group of people, knowing that they were going to spend the rest of their years on the red planet. And in exchange for never coming home again, they would have the notoriety and historical opportunity to be the first human explorers on a planet in our solar system, which is very attractive. I think great if you want to explore, adventure, learn, teach, share. What a great opportunity to do it.
Well, Kyle, thank you for the question. I love his answer, too, when I asked him if he would ever go. He said, not even likely in my hometown. Thanks, Kyle, for joining us. Here's an email from Alex in Rochester. Getting back to our discussion earlier about comets and the Rosetta mission, I'll throw this to you, I think, Mal. Alex says, how do comets and asteroids form? What is the original source of their materials, including their life-giving water? Alex, it's a great question. Thank you.
How much time do we have?
Yeah, right. Not much.
Well, asteroids, from what I remember, John will know because he teaches this stuff, but asteroids, like in the asteroid belt and so on, are all formed with the solar system. We have really big objects that formed. Again, starting around 4.6 billion years ago, the sun came into power and pushed all this stuff around, slamming into each other. So we have very large objects. We have very small objects, and they all settled in their different orbits. But the same with when the sun came into power, what are now the comets, as I understand it, were generally very close to the sun, and the pressure of that sun forming sent this material far out into the solar system. We have these two belts that we know of as the Kuiper Belt out beyond Neptune, as John said earlier. And further out than that, way out there, is this cloud just all these cometary objects we call the Oort cloud. And those names are just because of the scientists who thought about them originally. But we have their thought to be the very oldest objects in the solar system. And to another reason for the Rosetta, for example, is that because it is very old, we learn not only how comets outgas and form their tails and comas, but also we get to look at the materials there to help understand what the very early solar system was like. But they all formed together out of the same event.
The Big Bang?
No. Just our sun coming into being and forming our solar system. But they are two different types of objects. I mean, asteroids are rocks. And again, we have dirty snowballs.
Comets are dirty snowballs. All right. Well, I think we answered it a little bit, Alex, but obviously there's a lot more in that question. Coming up in 2015, two stories that I want to ask you guys about that may be the subject of our conversations next year. Speaking of far out objects, John Gianforte, we're going to get a Pluto examination coming up. That's cool.
That's right. The New Horizons mission, launched in 2006, has been on its way to Pluto. We'll arrive at Pluto, or we'll pass through the Pluto system on the 15th of July of 2015. And it's not going to hang around, unfortunately. It's going to pass through Pluto and its five orbiting moons.
Well, it's not going to go through it, is it?
Well, I hope not.
Through the orbit.
It'll go through the system and get a close encounter of Pluto and the five little moons that orbit it. And then it will be looking for other Kuiper Belt objects like Pluto out there.
Dwarf planets, they call it now.
Dwarf planets.
Was this mission started after Pluto was demoted?
No. Yeah, it was started much before.
It was
launched the year... The mission was launched, I think, in
2006.
January.
Yep.
And the vote by the International Astronomical Union that resulted in Pluto being classified as a dwarf planet and not a classical planet was in August of 2006.
That was a big deal. And we had Neil deGrasse Tyson on the show actually talking about that. He's the gentleman at the Planetarium in New York City who kind of got that whole ball rolling, right? And he wrote a book about the experience. And I think we talked to you about that too, John.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. So this mission started in January of that year, and Pluto was demoted 8 months later. But too late, it's already gone.
Well, everybody was worried about him calling the spaceship back because Pluto wasn't a planet anymore. But luckily, that would have cost too much money.
Well, here's another interesting story.
By the way, it's only 203 days to go before it actually encounters its closest approach to Pluto. Not that we're counting, of course, but...
Right. It is amazing. I mean, that's a long way to go. It's a long, long time, and yet it's still on target. I mean, I'm just impressed that they're able to figure that out. Here's something else that I wanted to ask you guys about. Next year, two astronauts, a Russian and an American, are going to live on the International Space Station, Mal Cameron, for a full calendar year. So who is doing that, and how significant is that?
We have an American astronaut and a Russian cosmonaut who have been in training. Scott Kelly, who has multiple trips to space on shuttle flights and so on. I believe, actually, if I think about it right, the one launch I had the pleasure to see was the launch of Barbara Morgan, who was Krista McAuliffe's backup astronaut when she went to space in 2007. And I believe Scott was the commander of that mission as well. But he's going with his partner is Mikhail Kornienko from Russia. And they're going to take off in March and spend a whole year in space. Now, normally, that's twice the normal hitch that you go to on the space station. And, of course, the reason is do lots of medical tests before they go. You find out what happens to them at the end of the year when they come down and they're just mush or something.
Because there's no gravity to keep their muscles in shape.
But this is an important step, again, on an eventual trip to Mars, because that's a long-term trip as well. It takes several months to fly to Mars. It took 10 months for MAVEN to fly to Mars, for example, because of its distance. So there's a long time in space. We need to know what happens to the human body. How can we overcome that? How can we keep the astronauts safe?
And just a personal note for astronaut Scott Kelly. He is the twin brother, right, of Mark Kelly.
Yes.
And they'll be sort of comparing the twin brothers and their biological processes.
That's right. They're identical twins.
Yeah, and one up there and one on Earth. Right. And
So which one is really going?
And Mark Kelly is, I think, the husband of Arizona Congresswoman Gabby Giffords.
Yes.
Yes,
okay,
right.
So
yes.
A couple interesting backstories there. I want to say Happy New Year to both of you.
Thank
you.
And
I think we've got a lot to talk about in the new year. Thank you so much for being here. Happy New Year, and we'll see you in 2015.
We're looking forward to it, Laura.
Great.
See you next year.
Mal Cameron, retired astronomy and space educator at the McAuliffe-Shepard Discovery Center. John Gianforte, astronomy lecturer at UNH and Granite State College. By the way, we just got an email from Susan who says, we at the Dover Public Library, like many libraries in the state, are part of the New Hampshire Astronomical Society's library telescope program. Libraries have telescopes available to their patrons to take home. So there you go. This is The Exchange on NHPR.